Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. I would like to welcome, first of all, a friend of mine for many decades. He is the president of Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut. He is the chairman of the New York St. Patrick's Day Parade. And John Lee, you are indeed very welcome to the program.
Great, Adrian. It's great being with you again.
John, I want to ask you if we can take your early days growing up in Riverdale in the Bronx, and your mother being, you know, a teacher, had the subject of the Irish famine. Was that covered in any curriculum? Was that was there much reference to that either in school or in the community as you reflect?
Yeah, no, it really wasn't, Adrian. As you probably know, back then, you know, you're talking, I was born in 1946, just after the war, and I attended St. Margaret's School where my mother taught from 1952 to 1960. And not only was it not taught in the schools back then, it was, you know, just barely referenced even at home. And again, I grew up in a typical Irish family in a typical Irish neighborhood where everyone in the neighborhood was Irish practically. And it was, you know, sort of referred to as that dark, you know, part of our past that, and I knew that my grandfather and my great grandparents, who were born during the famine actually in Ireland, in not Glasmore, just in County Kerry, just 10 miles from Tralee, on Tralee Bay there. You know, I knew they left. They survived the famine. They had three of their children. Ultimately, they had 11, and one of whom was Daniel Leahy. It actually was pronounced Leahy over there and
right,
spelled L-E-A-H-Y over there. And so I knew my grandfather came over here as a kid. He was 7 years old when they left Ireland. And so I knew that it was just a dark period in our history, and it really wasn't discussed very much. I just knew a lot of people died, and as a result, a lot of people to avoid death and suffering came to America, and that's why there were so many Irish in New York. So, but I really think it was avoided because, you know, I didn't realize it as a kid, but I did realize it now. It was just too painful an event to talk about. It was too recent an event. You know, it's only a generation, and they weren't far enough removed from it. And so, no, it was, we knew, we referred to it as the potato famine. We knew the potatoes failed and the terrible crop. We really didn't know the circumstances. And to be quite honest with you, Adrian, I really didn't know the truth about the Great Hunger until I read Christine Keneally's book in 1996. I'm kind of embarrassed to say that because I'm an educator and someone who prides himself on studying and keeping up with things. And it was not until I read her book that was, as I said, my great awakening about the Great Hunger, about what the real causes and consequences were. And it was a much more recent awakening for me about the Great Hunger. And as I look at Ireland today, it's not that dissimilar from what I grew up. It's still not, you know, it's referenced in the schools now a little bit, but that's a quite recent phenomenon. And it's still, for the Irish, I think, still too painful an event to look back on, or has been. But I wasn't prepared as a kid for it, other than the fact that it was a dark tragedy that occurred. And but we really, my family didn't talk about it much.
At the same time, growing up in Attymass in County Mayo in Ireland, where also my father and mother were teachers, there was very little reference to the famine. And in fact, my home parish was the first report from which the first report of death from starvation was again brought to the attention of the government through a parish priest at the time. There was practically, not only was it ignored, but slight references would have been made in the local area not to bring up the topic of the Great Hunger at all. The survivor guilt, it was too close to the bone. All of that became probably one of the greatest historical events in Ireland to be actually purposely ignored.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me, Adrian. Again, a kind of victim's mentality, I think, the Irish adopted. And you know, it's not surprising. It's happened in other places where similar circumstances have occurred. You know, rape victims, there's much historical and scientific data to show that, you know, they, again, blame themselves perhaps for why they were violated, and then they're too embarrassed to talk about it, or they feel guilt. So it's a kind of a victim syndrome, and of course it was intensified in the Irish case because, you know, England still ruled all of Ireland for another 75 years after the famine, and so they wrote the history of it, and they allowed it to be described from their point of view, obviously playing down the suffering and death and starvation of the Irish, and obviously minimizing their responsibilities in connection with this great tragedy.
You know, you referenced 1996 and Christine Keneally's you know, expose of the famine. The following year, John Leahy, you were you were the Grand Marshal of the St. Patrick's Day Parade in New York City. Of course, you were not.
No, that's right, 1997. You're right.
And I think that had you sought wide approval of making the theme as you were Grand Marshal, the theme referenced and actually exposing the tragedy of the hunger with an added Leahy expose of it not being an act of God, as to up to that point it was referred to, if at all, but that actually that the British indifference to the hunger was something that you know, as you you know, as the parade approached and you were selected as Grand Marshal, you fairly rattled you know, both governments, not only in Ireland but particularly in Britain, by digging up something that would have been very welcome to continue on without much reference at all. Let bygones be bygones. What was your reaction? Well, first of all, why did you feel it necessary to, you know, to take the layers back and expose that?
Well, it's, first of all, it was I had just recently, within the prior year, read Christine Keneally's book, and the more I read it and saw the documentation that she provided about the shipping records, actually, of food being shipped out of Ireland, just actually as the deaths increased up into 1847, in particular, the amount of food and livestock that was shipped out of Ireland past the starving mouths of Irish men, women, and children. I just got madder and madder about it. And it was just by chance, you know, that a year later, in 1997, I was asked to be the Grand Marshal. Now, I had the benefit of knowing that the Irish government and elements of the different state governments in the United States were going to, for the first time really in a fairly public way, have some commemoration of what was then the 150th anniversary of the Great Hunger. It always goes back to, well, the Great Hunger lasted for 7 years, really, from 1845 to 1852. It's 1847 is the year, the single year that's usually used as the benchmark for the Great Hunger. So 1947 was the 150th anniversary. So I guess it was a combination of having read Christine's book and being asked to be the Grand Marshal during that year. I guess the educator in me. I felt when I was selected Grand Marshal, Adrian, I was probably the youngest Grand Marshal by 20 or 30 years. And I probably was one of the first that was actually not born in Ireland. So most of my predecessors, and I knew many of them because I had been involved with the parade for 15 or more years already, used the Grand Marshal platform to talk about themselves and what life was like for them in Ireland and coming to America and so on. And since I didn't have that experience, I was born here in New York in the Bronx and just lived as an American, I needed to talk about something. And came to me quite expectedly or naturally that let's make the theme of the Great Hunger the theme of that year's parade. And I could tie into the commemorations in Ireland. It was the first time Ireland actually dedicated some public art to Rowan Gillespie's famine family figures in the Custom House Quay there in Dublin, and then John Behan's famine ship in Kirkpatrick in York County, Mayo. So that was the Irish government's first attempt at commemorating. Actually, interestingly, at the 100th anniversary in 1947, the Irish government did absolutely nothing in terms of commemorating. Again, it was too painful then and too short. 100 years later, it was still too painful to do anything. And America didn't do. The American Irish and the diaspora didn't do much. So it was a combination of those things, but you're absolutely right. I mean, this is only now, 20 years ago. When I was announced as Grand Marshal, I gave brief remarks about how I was going to make the Great Hunger the theme of that year's parade, and I was going to discuss it. I was actually attacked the same day by I forget his name, but he was the British ambassador in Washington, D.C., who attacked me that same day and said I should know better for an educated person than to call something like the Great Hunger or the Holocaust and this and that. And what was interesting about that is I never used the word Holocaust. I was very careful about Holocaust. Growing up in Riverdale, by the way, the other ethnic group in Riverdale where I grew up was Jewish. I knew well the sensitivity of that term in terms of being used in connection with the Nazism and the death and destruction of over 6 million Jews. So it was interesting that the British government both felt that they had to respond in very strong terms in 1997. And they used language that I didn't use, which I've interpreted as an attempt to not only take an unfair cheap shot at me, but to drive a wedge between the Catholic Irish and the Jewish community on the issue of the Great Hunger. So you're absolutely right. It was a very strong reaction. And even the parade officials, Jim Barker, who's gone on for his eternal reward. Jim was a great guy, but you either loved him or you hated him. And he had very strong views. I can remember after I made my announcement, my comments after being at the press conference, he said, "Oh, you did a great job there, John." He said, let's kill that famine stuff. We don't want to hear about that stuff during the year. So, yeah, even among the Irish in New York, it was still controversial enough. They weren't sure we needed to discuss it. But as I said, ultimately, the educator in me appropriately, I think, guided me to use the parade and the platform you get as a Grand Marshal to when you go to all these county events and Emerald Society events and leading up to the parade, and they expect you to say a few words. I just felt the educator in me should try to educate people about an important topic that had, up until that time, really had not been communicated in a public way. So, as I said, it came quite naturally. It wasn't just my idea. New York, Governor Pataki, commissioned a memorial that was ultimately built down in Battery Park City area to the Great Hunger. The curriculum was added. The Great Hunger was added to the social studies curriculum in New York that year. I testified in Hartford, and the Connecticut government also approved adding the Great Hunger to the social studies curriculum for middle school students in Connecticut. So there were a lot of activities going on, and so it seemed to me quite natural and appropriate that I would use my tenure as Grand Marshal to talk about the Great Hunger.
Before the advent of the internet and on that famous day in 1997, our own programs had linked to various places throughout the world, as far away as Australia, New Zealand, and the reaction to that was very mixed. Again, we were back to, why bring it up now, to those who said, never knew that, and what's happening not only in Ireland, or the lack of what was happening in Ireland, with the exception of Strokestown in County Roscommon, where the family museum was well underway. But there was international inquiries. Wait a minute, why do we never know this? It became an international inquiry and awareness, and one again that many felt, listen, what the hell do we need that for, particularly on St. Patrick's Day? Why throw a temper in it? It was an amazing and historic day and a move that led to such a great history and movement, which actually brings us up to this very day. But before we speak about,
no, you're right, Adrian. I'll remind you and thank you also. I was on your show that day. After later in the evening of St. Patrick's Day in 1997, and you asked me that very question. Why did I? Basically, I think you were saying to me, why did you bring this upon yourself? Why did you feel the need to do this? And I think you were reflecting the controversy and understood it in a much broader context than I did. So sometimes. Ignorance is bliss, I guess, and just stumble along into something. But I felt it was the right thing to do at that time, and maybe I should have been concerned, but I wasn't about the festivity of the day. And as I said, I think it was a time to turn the parade into a more serious discussion, even if it at that time were a controversial discussion. And I think in hindsight, I couldn't be happier with the changes that have occurred. I think it's been truly remarkable now that, I mean, literally our collection is going to Ireland here in a couple of weeks. It's over there actually right now. We're opening it on the 7th of March, I think it is. I haven't heard a single negative thing from the British government about our Great Hunger collection, our collection, which is a very powerful statement about this, which will be in Dublin and in Cork City, in Skibbereen, in Cork and in Derry. So for whatever controversy it may have raised on March 17th back in 1997, I couldn't be happier with the change that has occurred in the U.S. and Ireland and England and elsewhere in terms of the appropriateness of looking back on the Great Hunger, finding out things that should have been done differently, and in the hopes that a similar occurrence will not occur again. Although sadly, there are some similarities to starvation and suffering, and certainly discrimination that continues, as we all know, worldwide.
Can I bring you back to your career in Quinnipiac University, as president of Quinnipiac University, now in your 31st year, and the challenge of taking a very small, pretty much unknown rural university up in Hamden, Connecticut, and what your vision was to bring that to where it is today, probably one of the best-known universities in the United States, some of it having to do with the famous Quinnipiac poll. But what was your foresight at that time? Did you at all think that the day would come when you could take this small university and grow it into what it is today?
Well, I did when I arrived at Quinnipiac in March of 1987. It was a small institution, 1,900 students, just had three schools and 100 acres and virtually no endowment, and it actually had an enrollment decline from 1982 to 1986 at 20%. So it clearly wasn't going in the right direction. It had a couple of things going for it, though, that I was impressed with. First of all, it was located, while Hamden wasn't well known, Yale University and New Haven was only 5 minutes to the south of us. So it certainly had things in the greater New Haven area that were strong and that Quinnipiac could take advantage of. We were also located between Boston and New York City, two of the huge cities, not to mention two cities that the Irish, to a significant degree, built. And it was also located on a campus that was attractive, a 100-acre campus that was next to a 1,500-acre state park. So I saw the potential. I must say it needed work, and it also had three schools at that time, a School of Liberal Arts, a School of Business, and a School of Health Sciences. So, and the School of Business and the School of Health Sciences were strong, professional-oriented programs. So what it needed to do basically was to grow. 1900 was not going to be large enough. To grow, you had to go outside of Connecticut. We had, it was 80% students, 80% of whom were from Connecticut back then, 31 years ago. And Connecticut is a small state and actually a net exporter of students. So if you were going to grow, you had to go outside of Connecticut. If you were going to go outside of Connecticut, you had to get better known. You're quite right. It was not only unknown. Its name was almost unpronounceable out of greater New Haven. In New Haven, it was well known because we had a Quinnipiac Bridge and Quinnipiac Club, and Quinnipiac Native Americans were there before it was the New Haven colony. But outside, it was totally unknown. So all those things made it clear to me that you had to get the word out about Quinnipiac on a broader regional and ultimately national basis, and so that led to my starting the poll, which helped to get the word out and get a few more people pronouncing it correctly. And then we had to add more programs to attract more students, and we had to advertise in New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania and Ohio and so on to get before you can get students in there. You have to get known and have some visibility. We started recruiting in those areas, and athletics was important, so we eventually moved from Division II to Division I athletics and developed a national powerhouse hockey program, both in women's and men's hockey. And we had the School of Communications, School of Education, and all those were things that I pretty much did have in mind were, generally speaking, in broad terms, what I would need to do to grow Quinnipiac and put it on a stronger, both academic and financial basis. I can't tell you, talking to you today, that I knew in 1987 that we needed to acquire a law school, that we needed to add a medical school. Those two were came along. They were perfect fits for my vision of adding more professional schools, where we're not a research-oriented university. We're a school where students come to earn a degree and get an education that is a practical, so that they're in careers where there are tremendous opportunities for jobs. So that's our strength. So that's why a law school fit, a medical school fit, a School of Engineering that we added 5-6 years ago was a good fit. So I didn't have all the pieces in mind, but I had the concept that we had to expand geographically, we had to expand the enrollment. To do all those things, you You had to get visibility outside of Connecticut. You also had to expand the campus because to bring in more students from outside the area, now you had to build more dormitories and all the rest. So, you know, I had the concept in mind. I would say, Adrian, and that's the philosopher in me. I had the concept right and clear. I didn't know all the pieces that would play out, but it, you know, in hindsight, to me, it played out in a quite logical and appropriate manner. And 31 years later, we're now, you know, 10,000 students instead of three schools. We're nine schools and colleges. Instead of one campus with 100 acres, we're three campuses with 750 acres. Instead of a $3 million endowment, we now have a $530 million endowment. You know, it's there's no question, and it's been written up. It's not just you know, this president saying it. It's been written up in many national publications, educational and non-educational. You know, the transformation of Quinnipiac from a small local Connecticut college, as you said, almost unknown outside of Greater New Haven, into a major nationally recognized university of some significant size and academic stature, and is one of the great success stories in higher education, literally transforming this small place into a major institution. And quite honestly, you know, as I'm near the end of my tenure here on June 30th, 2018, I'll be 31 years and 3 months, I am even more bullish that now that where we are today, that we probably won't grow in terms of the student body, but the recognition of Quinnipiac, the quality, and our goal is to get our endowment up to $1 billion in the next 10 years for our 100th anniversary, which will be 2029, I'm even more bullish that Quinnipiac is going to continue to explode on the scene in higher education and be recognized increasingly as, and this is our long-term goal, is to get Quinnipiac in the top 100 ranked universities in America in as many categories as we can. We're already in the top 100 in a number of categories, yeah. And we're knocking on the door in some other areas. So I see that happening over the next 10 to 20 years, I'm confident that with the base that we now have and the visibility that we have and the financial resources, there'll be a lot more people jumping on the Quinnipiac bandwagon from this point forward. Back 30 years ago, as I look back, I was happy just to get a few people like a Murray Lender and a Clara Buckman and a Fred Manchesky and to help build the bandwagon, or to at least repair the bandwagon. And now that task is accomplished, and we have indeed a very fine bandwagon, and I think we'll get even more people now wanting to be part of the success story that we have and will help us hopefully get to even greater success in the years ahead.
You mentioned Murray Lender, and he was a student at Quinnipiac University, right?
He was a Quinnipiac graduate, exactly right, yes.
Now, how did you get his attention, since he becomes very much a part of the closeness of, you know, whereas you have programs and partnerships with organizations around the world, you have a particular, Quinnipiac has had a particularly strong bond with Ireland. But here's a Murray Lender now, you know, he became part of the alumni of Quinnipiac. How did that relationship develop to where he became a major contributor and sponsor to everything having to do basically with the Ireland's Great Hunger, even before the museum? Can you bring us to that?
Sure. Yeah. No. Like as with everything in life, Adrian, you know, you plan work as best you can. You prepare to make sure you're there, but timing is everything, and being in the right place at the right time. So it was very fortunate. I got to Quinnipiac in March of '87. I asked our alumni people there who was the most successful alum. I actually asked them who was the wealthiest alum as well. And the quick response was Murray Lender. And he's a Quinnipiac graduate. And if I had asked that question 10 years earlier and they tried to get in touch with him, I probably wouldn't have been successful. As it turned out, he and his brother Marvin had just sold the company two years earlier, in 1985, to Kraft. And prior to that, for 30 or 40 years, Murray was on the road selling frozen bagels. He was a major leader in the frozen food. For those of us who are of your age or my age, we remember when frozen food came into being. And he was a leader in that and had the brilliant idea of if I froze these bagels and I could sell them to everybody. I wasn't just going to be delivering fresh bagels from Lender's little bakery in my backyard to Jewish people. And that was the genius of the frozen bagel for Murray. Fortunately, he had just now settled down back in New Haven and was really looking to do something and give back to the community. He was a wealthy person, as was his brother at that point, and didn't need to work anymore, although he stayed on as a spokesperson for Kraft and Lender's Bagels for another 5 or 6 years. So as it turned out, he was in the area, so alumni vice president got a hold of him and told him the new president wanted to meet him. And he came into my office. It took a month or two, and I told him that my vision was for Quinnipiac in the broad terms we just discussed, and most of all, I needed someone like him on the board to provide leadership so that we could achieve the vision I was talking about. And again, if I had asked him that question 10 years earlier, we may not have even been able to get a hold of him because he was traveling all over the country. But at that point, it was just perfect timing for him. He said yes in my office about joining the board and then became a leader. And as I've said a number of occasions, that transformed the board because he was so well known, so well respected and thought of that people changed their perception of Quinnipiac College, which it was back then, that this must be a more substantial place than I thought it was because Murray Lender wouldn't be part of something that wasn't a pretty substantial and credible organization. And so he also helped us attract other corporate leaders, Fred Manchesky, who was CEO of Eklund, and Frank O'Keefe, who was CEO of Armstrong Tire and others. So he's very instrumental there. And, of course, his generosity is well known, his name and family name, along with his brother Marvin, Grace, our Lender School of Business Center, our Lender Court and our gymnasium. We have Lender Scholarships. So he's been very philanthropic. And then this was, again, a total surprise to me and a little bit of serendipity. The year I was the Grand Marshal, Murray was so excited about this. He actually marched in the parade that year. And his comment after the parade was he didn't know he could have that much fun in life without doing something illegal. That's how much he enjoyed marching up Fifth Avenue with the Quinnipiac contingent. But after I was finished with my year there as Grand Marshal, Murray had heard a lot of these speeches I gave on the Great Hunger. And I was out in California visiting him soon after the parade and soliciting a gift from him for our library, which we were going to basically double or triple the size of. So it was a major fundraising project. So I was out there to talk to him about a gift for that project. And that was the first time I learned what my speeches about the Great Hunger and the impact it had on someone. Murray told me, he said, look, John, I'm going to give you a gift for the library, and I'm going to get my brother Marvin to match it. But he said, I wanted to go to this Great Hunger. He said, I lived in New Haven all my life, and I had it was a big Jewish community, a big Italian community, and a big Irish community. He said, I never heard about the famine, not once. He said, when we talk about the Holocaust, obviously, all the time, and I talk with my Irish friends about it, but they never talked to me about this Great Hunger. He said, and so Murray, I think, so I don't know that he saw, direct comparisons with the Holocaust itself. I'm sure he did, but I also think he understood extremely well and firsthand the immigrant experience, because his parents left Poland, thankfully, in the 1930s with the rise of Hitler. They saw what was coming. And they very well, if they had not left Poland in the 30s and come to New Haven, they would likely have been a casualty of most of the Jews, and a majority of those who died in the Holocaust were from Poland. So he understood what his parents had to do to pick up everything, leave their native Poland, come to the U.S. You know, they didn't speak the language here. You know, they weren't particularly well welcomed here, and they had to start their own little business, little bakery in their backyard, and work long hours. And so I think he really appreciated that the Irish went through exactly the same thing, that the great hunger and the death and the suffering in Ireland was similar to, in some respects, to the suffering and mass killings of the Jews in Europe. But in particular, the immigrant experience was the parallels were even stronger to what the Irish had to suffer when they came to this country post the Great Hunger. So it's amazing. When I dedicated or spoke at the dedication of our Great Hunger Museum 5 years ago, I mentioned there was a group of dignitaries here. In fact, Leo Varadkar, who was the minister representing Ireland, I think he was the minister of tourism, and representing Ireland at the dedication, and Noel Kilkenny, the consul general, and others who were there. In my remarks, I said, you know, a lot of Irish and Irish Americans are responsible for the dedication of this museum on Gorta Mór that we're dedicating it today. But I said, let's never forget, if it weren't for the son of immigrant Jews from Poland, Murray Lender and his brother Marvin, you know, this wouldn't have happened. So it was really Murray's and sisters. Look, I'm going to give you a gift, but it's going to go to the Great Hunger. So when we opened the library in 2000, 3 years later, we had in it the Lender special collection room on Gorta Mór with collection of artwork and educational materials and so on. And so that was the start of it, that Murray's gift went for all that acquisition during that three-year period. But then after that, he continued to support desire to add to the collection, both the library and educational resources, as well as the art collection, that ultimately led to the collection being so large that we had to get a building near campus and renovate it into the museum that it is today. So you're right. Murray was, in my mind, the most pivotal person I met and relationship I built. And he was the single most important person in the transformation of Quinnipiac from when he joined the board in 87. So everything happened, you know, after that. And he also became just a wonderful friend and as did Marvin. And I was so touched they asked me to speak at his funeral, which he and my mom died within a few days of one another. My mom died, yes. I guess it's 5 years ago now, 5-6 years. But she died. I learned of it the day before St. Patrick's Day that year. And then, so she died on March 16th. And I just got home, it was either 18th or 19th, and I got a call from Marvin Lender that Murray had just died. So they died within 1 week. But Marvin continues to be supportive, but you're right. It's interesting, and I think a great part of the story that it was a Jewish son of Polish immigrants that saw the compelling nature of the Great Hunger story, and it was his resources and that of his brother Marvin that helped to move it along and create the museum that we have today, as I mentioned earlier, the collection going to Ireland here. Well, it's in Ireland actually right now, but it will be opening in Dublin Castle just next week on March 7th.
And it goes from, as you said, it goes down to the Illan Arts Centre in Skibbereen and then on to Derry. Let me ask you about how the selection of which art pieces was made. I know there are 50 plus artworks. heading for Ireland.
Correct.
How was that?
Well, in the early days of 1997, I didn't know, I have to plead, I didn't know much of anything about Irish art. So I had to go over to Ireland and educate myself, which I did in the summer of 97, the summer of 98. And then I was fortunate enough, I knew Conor Kenny and the Kenny Bookstores in Galway.
Yes.
His parents, of course, were legendary there. And they had a relationship, and he had a relationship with our library. They were primarily in the books area, but they were getting into art, actually. In fact, the company has been transformed more into an art company today. But I met Connor, and so he was my kind of key person in Ireland that could educate me and keep his eye on things in Ireland to identify Irish art related to the Great Hunger. And I should tell you, in 1997, that was not a huge area of art. In fact, the Irish artists who were any good were, just as we were talking about, not talking about the Great Hunger. They were basically told not to to produce artwork for the Great Hunger because no one would be interested in it, and it wouldn't help advance their career either in Ireland or certainly not outside of Ireland. So Connor was extremely helpful in the original group of pieces that we acquired, ultimately just over 100. And then about 6 or 7 years ago, when we were preparing to actually build a museum as opposed to having a collection of art and educational materials on the Great Hunger, we did come into contact with Neville Sullivan, who was a distinguished Irish professor of art and at the College of Art and Design, and she was appointed our official curator for the museum itself when it was under renovation, and then the selection of art to be placed in the museum had to be decided. So she was and continues to be to this day. And then taking a little over 100 pieces of art that we have in our museum in Hamden, deciding ultimately, I think it's 52 pieces, so just about half of the collection that's going over there. Again, Neville Sullivan was the critical person deciding what pieces were the most appropriate that needed to go there. And then one piece we actually acquired that I'm interested in seeing that I haven't seen in the last, I guess it was a year and a half ago or thereabouts, we purchased a piece by Dorothy Cross, who's a very famous Irish artist, and she had a piece that was it's a boat with shark skin spread on it, and in any event, it was a very well thought of piece. We ultimately acquired it. It was on exhibit in London at the time. It was subsequently, after we purchased it, it was moved to Ireland. So I have not seen that piece, other than pictures of it. That will be in the collection. We decided the timing was such there's no point bringing it over here and then shipping it back. So I've been fortunate to have kind of Kenny and the Kenny people, and then more recently Neve. Both of whom have, you know, educated me and have helped make the decision about what art we collect and purchase, and then ultimately what went into the museum. And of course, in the museum in Hamden, we rotate some of the pieces because, as I said, there are more than we can accommodate at any one time in the museum.
I think it's probably appropriate to point out that a lot of the artwork that you have purchased, identified purchased, was actually not in Ireland. It had much of it was, you know, found in England and Britain, and it might indicate again some of the, you know, awareness that even the art history of Ireland, you know, was kind of quite easily, you know, gotten rid of at the time, probably because, again, the attitudes of those in Ireland across the board might have said, okay, you know, there's no, let's not rush to have this, you know, collection exclusive to Ireland. So let it go. Let some of it go at least.
Yeah, no, I think you're quite right, Adrian. I mean, and that's why there, first of all, there is very little contemporary art, I mean, contemporary to the Great Hunger itself. I mean, obviously back in the mid-19th centuries, you had to have patrons and the people who had money to buy art that were hanging in their residences and elsewhere. Obviously, were the, you know, the Anglo and the Anglo-Irish. They didn't want pictures of starving Irish hanging up on their walls and reminding them of their, some of their responsibilities that they didn't live up to. So you didn't have a whole lot. You had a few pieces, McDonald pieces, which one of which we have, and then you had some British oriented paintings and Scottish that depicted the Irish in demeaning ways. Erskine Nicholls is a good example. We have one of his pieces, Knotty Point, showing the Irish as basically reinforcing the stereotype of their being drunken and lazy and so on. And so you had very little accurate artwork and some inaccurate produced during that period. And then I'll tell you how recent it has been that if the Irish artist wanted to you know, develop a good reputation, in many cases he had to leave and go to France or London or you know, various parts of Europe, and they didn't want to see famine-related art. And I can tell you how recently Rowan Gillespie, who was commissioned by the Irish government to do those famine pieces down at the Custom House Quay there in Dublin, in conjunction with the 1997 150th anniversary, his father tried to talk him out of doing it. This is 1997. And Rowan told me, Rowan's become a dear friend too, it saddened him. His father would never visit after he was finished. You know, he told me, he said, well, look, Dad, this is important. The Irish government is commissioning this. It's an important piece to talk about so that it's there commemorating this. So, I mean, again, as recently as 1997. Now, Rowan was already a pretty well-known sculptor and had a great reputation, but his own father tried to talk him out in 1996 or whatever about doing this project. So you're absolutely right. There was now, I must say, Quinnipiac probably contributed to, in some degree, because we became a not insignificant market for this kind of art. Now, if an artist is even thinking about some painting or sculpture or whatever related to Great Hunger, we'll get a call about it in advance. So we're actually quite well known that we're a place that has high quality and a commitment to Great Hunger related art, and so things have, I've seen the change. It's been dramatic in the last 21 years what's happened in this area. But you're right, our collection spans from you know, paintings from James Arthur O'Connor back in the 1820s all the way up to contemporary pieces by Dorothy Cross and others. So it really spans the from the Great Hunger all the way up to the present. But most of the artwork, where the content is clearly and quite intentionally about the Great Hunger, the overwhelming majority of that has been produced in the last 25 years.
Now, it's well to note, and nobody will challenge this, that that Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut, has the largest, it contains the world's largest collection of Great Hunger-related art by notice Irish and Irish-American art. That's quite a proud claim. But again, it kind of, whereas this is the largest collection, the interest that it has stirred throughout, you know, particularly with the Irish bond with America, it has stirred up quite a level of interest, particularly in Ireland, which makes this your exhibition, your coming home, Art and the Great Hunger exhibition poignant.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Adrian. It's a not only the largest collection of art in particular, really, there's not even anything that's a close second. And you're right about the excitement. I've just gotten some feedback from Neve, who's over there. Neve wrote a beautiful piece that was in the Irish Times this Sunday on the collection. Dublin Castle has indicated that they have never gotten such phone calls and inquiries about the collection and when it's going to be open to the public. So it's already created quite a stir. As I said, I'll be flying over there tomorrow, actually, and I'll arrive on Monday, March 7th, and I think the opening, I think we have a VIP opening on the 8th, and President Higgins will be speaking at that event, and I got a wonderful call from your dear friend Ed and Kenny as well, who wants to get together with me while I'm over there. And, you know, I want to thank the former Taoiseach for his support. The Irish government has given $100,000 to support the collection going over there, which is quite a significant gift to a U.S. University, museum-based U.S. university. And it reflects, I think, Enda Kenny and his Mayo background that you're well aware of, and his interest in the Great Hunger Collection going over there. And, of course, he experienced the collection himself being in Hamden at an event where we gave him an honorary degree, and he toured the collection. But I've heard it's already created quite a lot of interest, and I'm really very excited about getting over there and to see it firsthand. And I think it opens officially to the general public to the March 8th or March 9th. And then you're right, it'll be in Dublin Castle for 3 months, and then we'll pack it up and move it to the West Cork Art Center in Skibbereen. Right. And it'll be there for 3 months. And then that was our original plan. And then our friends in Northern Ireland, Martino Muir and others, said to us, look, if it's we got to get the collection up to Northern Ireland. And so they raised another $100,000 so that we could move the collection there and have it in Derry City for 3 months as well. So we'll actually be in Ireland for the next 12 months, actually. I think it wraps up in Derry City around March 17th, 2019. So we'll be there for a full 12 months, and it'll be on display in each location for a full 3 months.
There, as we speak, I have to assume that many of our listeners would feel that this is great, but and I'm sure many will plan to visit the exhibitions in Dublin, Cork, and Derry. But there is, it's almost a secretive opportunity that's great. That's all done and dusted. However, I think a great number of people would like to contribute to some degree, towards the exhibition. And again, taking that bond between the U.S. and Ireland, that's still open. I know you've had, amazing sponsors from government to American Iron Fund to various others. But there is an opportunity here, and I know that your executive vice president, Lynn Bushnell, will go after both of us if we don't mention that there is an opportunity for people, ranging from small contributions to actually being a sponsor of the art pieces itself.
No, you're absolutely right, Adrian, and thank you for mentioning that. No, we've raised over, I don't know what the total is now. Last time I looked, it was $319,000, and we were hoping to raise $500,000. And we've covered the full cost of the collection getting over there, but you're right, there are opportunities to sponsor particular pieces of art in connection while they're over there and to give visibility to that. The other thing that I would really encourage your listeners to if they can help support us, is we want to leave a legacy of the collection being over there for the Irish people. So we have a variety of projects, some of which we're committed to because of we have received donations and sponsors for them, but others have not. We are developing some curriculum materials that we are going to be leaving for the schools so that they will be encouraged to educate the young Irish about the Great Hunger in the years to come. We're doing some video productions on the Great Hunger right. also. We have some academic scholarly conferences where we'll bring Irish artists and historians together to talk about the Great Hunger. So there are still quite a number of significant opportunities of things that we could do over the next 12 months in Ireland to make sure that when the collection is there for a year and we hope to generate all this excitement and interest in the topic and the collection, we want the discussion of the Great Hunger to go on in much more serious and continuous ways in the years ahead. So, yes, there, Lynn can, Bushnell and Ryan Mahoney, our executive director, and you can contact on our website the and see the opportunities for the continued support of the programming-related activities that we'll be doing while the collection is over there and being viewed, particularly directed to young children. That's right. The group that needs to be educated, the next generation of Irish, so that they're a little better educated. And again, not to education is not all fun and happy things. You know, there have been sad and dark parts of our human history that it's important that they not be forgotten, you know, lest they happen again. And, you know, all these areas, it's amazing to me that, you know, discrimination and bigotry and racism, you know, the similarities are so obvious to me. I mean, the suffering and the discrimination against the Irish in the 19th centuries by the Know-Nothings and so on, and you look at the discrimination and bigotry today toward, Mexican Americans and or Eastern European, and we've just changed the groups, and so the story of the Great Hunger and the story of bigotry and discrimination against the Irish for being Irish and for being Catholic continues to this day. It's a universal, unfortunately, story, and all we've done is change the groups and change the religion, but there's still plenty of bigotry and hatred and discrimination. So the more we can educate people about the past and the similarities between the past and the present, I think the more likelihood we can be able to prevent such occurrences in the future.
Finally, I would like to make a couple of points. Number one, Visual Art and as the Coming Home Art and the Great Hunger Collection heads for Ireland, I'm sure you'll get quite a welcome from the former Minister for Tourism going back to the opening, who is now, of course, Taoiseach, Prime Minister of Ireland, and having the President of Ireland being the official greeter and person who's welcoming to an excellent degree the Coming Home Art and the Great Hunger Project. You'll also, as you mentioned, have a former Taoiseach and a great supporter in Andy Kenny. And, you know, he being receiving an honorary doctorate in 2015, which he still maintains as one of his most significant awards during his reign as Taoiseach. That was 2015. There was another one in 2016 that I would like to mention, and that is, without a doubt, my most prized possession and honor in receiving an honorary doctorate from Quinnipiac University. I thank you. I notice Andy Kenny and so many others who have been involved with Quinnipiac University and those of us who admire with great relish and fondness your leadership in Quinnipiac University. We're sorry. It's coming to an end. But after 31 years at the helm of Quinnipiac University, we barely understand that you're leaving, but your own legacy has been has been amazing. And it's great that we tie in, Ireland and the Great Irish Hunger, the Great Irish Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, the Great Irish Hunger Institute. You're leaving a very significant legacy, and I want to thank you, John Leahy.